All right, hi, so my name's Andy Bissett.
I'm James Allen.
And this is the Ball Chat Sports Podcast.
And also the Germans like putting the boot to England in there as well.
The thing is, yeah, it's going to be... We never beat them, do we, really? When was the last time we beat them? 1966 in the World Cup final. Have we ever actually beat them in a major competition since then?
But when's the last time you've seen England? I know they're failing to score that many goals, but they look defensively pretty solid.
Yeah.
And we've hit the woodwork in every game. You know what I mean? We could have well had 4, 5, 6 goals by now. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So I don't know. I know they look pretty crushing against Portugal, but I'm not. They're not like a proper German team, are they? Not really.
I don't know, man. Based on their team sheet, you look at their team sheet, and they have got still got some really, really, really good players, like fantastic players all over the pitch. But I don't think they're playing like a German team, as the German teams that we saw in the past. Probably not as. I don't know whether that's partly down to that. Joachim Löw, like he's kind of at the end of his tenure, isn't it? And you know, is it Hans Flick?
Yeah,
he's meant to be taken over after the Euros, isn't it? So that was arranged sort of like end of May.
That Löw's so been there 15 years as well. It could just be getting a bit stale.
Because they didn't qualify for the World Cup, did they? And might have to have this chat again, like when it comes right round, but. All right, so welcome to another episode of the Ball Chat Sports Podcast. It's a pleasure to be sat next to Mr. James Allen today as we go through what's happened since last week in the Euro Group Stage games. Now we know who will be competing in the last 16 knockout games. So nice to see you, Jim.
It's so good to be doing this without the half a second Zoom call delay that throws off the mechanics of many a good conversation. It's a pleasure to see you again.
And at least we haven't got the dog grunting down the mic as well.
Oh, mate, that's... I swear he was doing that on purpose, but yeah, no, your cat's downstairs, where is he? Well, he's quiet anyway, so he'll be alright.
Yeah, he's pretty chill. And there's going to be some corkers in that last 16 game, definitely. I mean, obviously, England-Germany, that's going to be the big one. Belgium-Portugal, that's going to be a really, really good game. So we're going to talk about those in a little bit, and we also are going to have a brief overview of our predictor and what the keys to victory might be for that England game up against the old enemy Germany. And Jim, as always, will give us his surgical analysis of the exciting fights from last weekend. So we'll get started with the five things you might have missed. So number one, the Vanarama National League playoff between Torquay and Hartlepool was about as dramatic as they come on Sunday, as Torquay United goalkeeper Lucas Cugnari scored in the 95th minute to take the game to extra time. It was all in vain, however, as the game finally went to penalties in which Hartlepool won 5-4. You would have to say immense mental resolve from the Hartlepool players to be so close and then to have snatched away from you. So, you know, then having to step up and take the dreaded penalties to decide a place in the Football League. So it sounds like great entertainment for the 6,600 fans present. And Jeff Stelling will be happy because he's a Hartlepool fan.
Oh, yeah, I remember him saying that on Sports Soccer Saturday. And also, I can't believe there's extra football going on. I'm absolutely inundated with football from the Euros. I can't keep up with all this, man.
That's what I mean. I don't know what they're still doing. I think the conference had like a massive backlog of games. I guess that's why the playoff final is at the end of June and everyone else was kind of like over a month ago now. So I have no idea why, but I guess it's because of COVID. So so there you go. So Hartlepool will be back in the Football League, which is great for them because they've been out of there for a few years. So number two, we are now 19 years on from that spectacular or fluky, whichever way you're inclined, free kick that Ronaldinho scored against a despairing David Seaman in 2002 World Cup. And I know that every England fan will know exactly where they were when this goal went in. So Ronaldinho actually ended up getting sent off in the 58th minute, but England failed to capitalise after conceding two goals following the Michael Owen opener, courtesy of your Lucio era. Do you remember that one as well?
You know what? I remember this game. I remember watching it in the hall in Our Lady of Lourdes Primary School. We came in early to watch it because obviously it was in Japan and really early in the day. I didn't remember that Ronaldinho got sent off. I do remember Michael Owen's opener and that free kick itself. At the time, I was thinking, how has that just happened? But further reflection, a bit of space from the event, I think it was a fluke, you know? I think that was a cross.
Yeah, I mean, I've looked at it. I was re-watching the highlights and stuff, and like the first goal, Brazil's first goal was incredible. Like, I don't think we realise how good Ronaldinho was. Like, he was absolutely incredible. I think he definitely should be considered like one of the best players of all time. Skill-wise, he was on another level, and I think he just dominated England that game. You know, even though he got sent off in the 58th minute, he still created a goal and scored a goal. And I remember being down the Bear Pub in Sparkhill to watch it after they'd open up at like 7 in the morning, get all the alcoholics straight in, having to get a lift, and I had to get a lift straight into Scorlot and, you know, after the game. So sorry to bring back that football PTSD, England fans. And, you know, funnily enough, if you watch that red card decision back, it looks very similar to the incident with Wales' Ethan Ampadu on Sunday evening, if you managed to see that one, Jim.
Yeah, the stamp on his foot.
Yeah.
I thought they were really hard done by there for that, because we've discussed it in the group several times where the officiating, what's a foul, what's not, even offsides, handballs, all those kind of things, they are constantly moving and being reimagined, reassessed as the tournament goes on. And it is a little bit more free-flowing. They are a little bit more lax. But it's just, what's a foul, what's not? What's a yellow card, what's a red card? It's still all up in the air for me.
And supposedly this was another one of those pieces of conduct that the UEFA officials had sort of targeted prior to the game. Said, like, this is something you're not allowed to do. So, you know, I think the referee had his hands tied. But, you know, in my opinion, there's another decision that's kind of like, right, we're losing the art of the tackle and the art of the challenge. Because if that's a red card, and then there's a penalty that was from last night's games that we're going to talk about a bit later, where Mbappe was just basically, you know, shoulder barged. Not even shoulder barged, it was just shoulder to shoulder. He didn't even really have any force, and he went down, and the referee gave a penalty via VAR, but we'll talk about that a little bit later. And number three, sticking with England, disappointment, because we're used to that. John McGinn apparently gave Scotland right-back Stephen O'Donnell tips on how to wind up Jack Grealish, and I love this. He told him to start nibbling in his ear and don't be critical of him, but be complimentary. So O'Donnell was apparently telling him how good-looking he was, that he loved his calves, and asking him how he gets his hair to look the way he does. Ultimate shithousery, and something we absolutely condone on this podcast.
Yeah, dude, that's an interesting insight into Jack Grealish's mentality, because my mum hates Jack Grealish because he comes across as like an arrogant so-and-so. All the drunk driving things and all the bits with escorts and all that, she just don't like him. But doesn't that just tell you something, that he can't be that arrogant if he shies away from compliments that much? That's really, that is quite interesting to me. But his playing style, I mean, again, we're going to get into this, but he's a fantastic player, man. And England, like, a different side with him. But I'll take number four. And this is something that we were passing around between ourselves in the group. And, well, I'm sure it'd be divisive. So this past Monday, Laurel Hubbard, a transgender weightlifter from New Zealand, was selected for the women's team scheduled to compete at the Tokyo Games this summer, leading to a predictable schism in the world of sporting debate. And here's a little quote from yesterday's Guardian that fairly encapsulates the whole situation. So in 2015, the IOC issued guidelines allowing any transgender athlete to compete as a woman provided their testosterone levels were below 10 nanomoles per litre for at least 12 months before their first competition. Some scientists have said the guidelines do little to mitigate the biological advantages of those who have gone through puberty as males. Advocates for transgender inclusion argue the process of transition significantly decreases that advantage. And physical differences between athletes means there is never truly a level playing field. Now, Hubbard has already competed in weightlifting to no acclaim before her transition in 2013. Now she's world level, and that tells you all you need to know. So if there's never truly an even playing field, why separate men and women at all? Let's have Tyson Fury versus Katie Taylor. Do you know what I mean? Let's have a horrible free-for-all and see what happens. I respect the fact that sports committees and organisations are trying to be inclusive, but it's not fair to the rest of the women who are out there. She's going to dominate at the games. She's going to be setting all kinds of world records in the women's category. Now, I said he either make a trans category for themselves, a separate one, because, you know, I don't care if it's not deep enough. It's not fair for her to be in with the women. I have no feeling whatsoever towards the political machinations or the social machinations of it. That's fine, I respect the decision, but how can you condone that if you're the New Zealand selection committee?
It can't be justified by any Olympic body or really anybody that's involved with the sport, I don't think. Obviously, we don't want to touch it because it is a bit of it's political dynamite, really, isn't it? Do you know what I mean? You don't really want to sort of get too in it on this podcast, but I have a complete agreement with you because it's not fair. Like, the biological differences are still there to be seen, and the fact that, you know, she was an amateur weightlifter in the men's category, what do you say, 2013?
Yeah.
And then she's already gone and won a silver in the World Championships in 2017. And she's had extra training on top of that now. So she is going to dominate. And, like, who's going to applaud her if she wins gold?
Well, the thing is, if, and this is what you're saying, it's like political dynamite, is because if you touch this and you in any way dismissive or critical of it, then all of a sudden you're a bad guy. And it's not like, oh, you're not up for people being who they are. Like, you're not with the transmit. No, it's not that. It's that there are clear physical differences between men and women. And if you've spent most of your life as a man and go through puberty as a male, and you get to 30 and you say, oh, okay, I actually feel like I'm a woman, and you go through that change, that's your right. But in the arena of sporting competition, it's not fair. So we'll leave that where it is. I'm sure we'll get the blue haired brigade on our backs if there's any problems with that. But get at us on social media. Any interaction is good interaction. And in the same kind of area in the political spectrum, we'll move to number 5. So the Las Vegas Raiders defensive end Carl Nassib becomes the first active NFL player to come out as openly gay. Nassib made the announcement with a self-recorded video clip during which he looked surprisingly pleased with himself, while also claiming he's a very private person. Nassib also made a $100,000 donation to the Trevor Project, which works to prevent teenage suicides among LGBT plus youths in the US, which is an admirable and generous contribution to make to a good cause. So he struck me as somebody who's quite comfortable with being gay. And I think, it was more the sporting environment he's in, because NFL, obviously, super macho, super, all muscled up. Everyone's like, you know, they're all jocks, aren't they, basically? Yeah. So to come out in that kind of arena, that kind of environment, does take some doing. But it did look to me like he was just putting out a Grindr post or something like that. He looked very, very smug with himself. But I'm happy that he made the donation, because, you know, confused teens, and especially now on social media and all that, they can go down the wrong path and cause themselves some harm. So it is a positive message overall.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be interesting to see how that's received amongst his teammates and the sort of players around the league. Because obviously I think there is probably a lot more people like him that potentially, you know, are gay, but haven't got maybe not the confidence to come out, but maybe they just don't want it to affect their work in life. And it, you know, I think we're getting to a point in society where everybody should feel comfortable no matter what their sexual orientation. So it's interesting to see how the sort of NFL approach this, and whether there's going to be fines, because you know that there's going to be comments coming out during the NFL games, because, you know, he at the moment, you know, we've already seen it in the NBA, I think, with Jeremy Lin and something to do with coronavirus and this and that. People say things in the heat of competition that they perhaps would not say in a normal conversation.
It's the same kind of brand of, as you say, shithousery that McGinn was advising, I can't remember his name now, to say to Jack Grealish. It's just one-upmanship, sportsmanship, and it's all about competition. Now, obviously, there's always the potential for that to bleed into something more sinister. But as you say, it is going to be quite interesting to see if the other NFL players in the opposing teams are really going to twist the knife on this one. I don't know. We'll see.
All right, so that's it for the 5 things you might have missed, or 5 things that you probably heard a lot about in that one. There's a couple in there that are going to be very on the tip of everyone's tongue. So we're going to review England's last 2 group games, because there has been 2 since we've last had this podcast. Obviously, we had the England-Scotland game on Friday night, and then we had the England-Czech Republic game on Tuesday. So we'll start off with the England-Scotland game. So we'll talk about, you know, team selection is a good place to start. So Southgate's team selection, do we think that he got that right? All right, so he started with Reece James and Luke Shaw. So he made those changes from the first game where he had Kyle Walker and Kieran Trippier at the right side, you know, on the left side, even though he's a right footer. I don't think we saw the same kind of impetus from England, did we, in that second game as we did in the first?
In all fairness, even against Croatia, the first half, they were looking good. Calvin Phillips penetrating through the lines, with Kane dropping off into more of an assisting role, but more like bringing other players into positions and that. I was really impressed with James, actually. He was credited for a goal line clearance at some point during the game.
Yeah.
Mings is ever looking solid. But, you know, the main thing about England is they do look quite comfortable in possession. I think Gareth Southgate has emphasised being comfortable in possession, but I think sometimes that does deteriorate into a pedestrian pace, and once they settle into that pace, it's really hard to speed them back up again. So with this team now, pretty similar to the first team selection, Mason Mount and Foden, they weren't really doing it on the night. And obviously, you look for players like that, the younger players who can possibly bring the game into the final third with some kind of speed, some kind of threatening attack. And I didn't really see it myself.
Yeah, and Calvin Phillips, he didn't really have the same kind of performance that he had in the first game.
It seemed like he was playing a different role to me. He wasn't marauding around the place, like causing
problems. A lot deeper. Yeah. I think he seemed a lot deeper. I don't know whether Southgate was particularly conscious about something in the Scotland tactical lineup that perhaps he thought, right, we need to play two holders. But I think there was a lot of criticism from fans saying, do we need two holding players against a team that we should be beating comfortably on paper based on this sort of personnel that they've got in their lineup?
There's a lot of top quality players in there though. A lot of Man United players. What is it? Who's McTominay plays for United, doesn't he? McGinn, he plays for Villa. McGregor, who's he play for now?
Celtic, I think.
So we can scratch that one off.
So you've got Robertson, Liverpool, you've got McTominay at United, Grant Hanley, I think he plays in the Championship. Tierney plays for Arsenal. O'Donnell, I think he plays in Scotland. John McGinn plays for Villa. Chadams plays for Southampton.
There's a load of good players in there, man. There are a load of good players, but again, you would expect to be like, if you got a chance at winning the whole tournament, and maybe this is an incorrect assumption on my side, because I was just about to say, you should be brushing teams like Scotland aside, but we've seen other big teams, teams that are bigger and better than England, struggle with the supposedly lesser teams. So maybe this is just an indicator that the smaller teams, the teams with less success in their history, maybe they're just better organised, maybe they've got a lot more players from top leagues around Europe and that. What do you think?
It's hard to say exactly why. When it comes to the international stage, it's very, you know, the only sort of like gauge we've got on how good a team is sometimes is obviously their previous tournament experience, which Scotland haven't got any recent previous tournament experience. Obviously, 23 years since they were last there. But you sort of gauge it based on the players and the personnel they've got in that team. And you say, all right, they've got players that play for Liverpool. They've got players that play for Arsenal, Man United. But it doesn't always work that way, does it? I think you get some players that come together in a unit and they look fantastic. England haven't really had that for such a long time. They've got players that are playing at top clubs. But when they bring them together, they seem quite mediocre. And I think that's happened with the Germany team now as well. They've got a lot of players that are playing at a high level around, you know, all around Europe. And you're bringing them together and they don't really look as good as they potentially could. You know, I don't think they're really hitting their potential. So are England hitting their potential with this, you know, with this team just yet? Maybe not, but we have to look at it. You know, it's three clean sheets at the end of the day.
You take that any day, wouldn't you, really?
Of course you would. Like, and you know, we've only scored two goals, both of them courtesy of Sterling. But I think we have created chances, but Scotland created chances as well in that game. You know, Pickford had to make a great save. I think it was from O'Donnell. Volley that came over and he had to make a smart save.
Scotland were definitely threatening more than England were, especially as the game wore on, because you could see as the clock was ticking down, they were thinking, all we need to do is nick a goal here, because England did not look like scoring. I mean, You think Foden just looked like, I don't know what was going on with Foden that game. It was the first time I've seen him and been thoroughly unimpressed. And I know it's a little bit harsh to single him out as one of the younger players especially, but you expect a lot from him. Look at what he's been doing at City. Do you know what I mean? And I know England play a different type of football, but I think Wayne Rooney nailed it where he's saying these kind of players, when you're at City and other top clubs, they play short, quick passes. England don't play that football. They need dribblers, they need to run in, and they need to like put the defender, pin them back, which is why players like Grealish and that have come on into the team and made such an impact. So Wayne Rooney obviously proven himself right there. And I think Foden, unless they maybe reimagine his role, give him a few different directives like Calvin Phillip had in that first game and looked so impressive, I think he's you could reasonably drop Foden after that Scotland game.
Yeah, I think it'd be hard not to perceive or to see Grealish getting into that game against Germany. Obviously, he's a good segue between the Scotland and the Czech Republic game. Because when he came on, it was almost like the weight of the world was on his shoulders when he came on. You know, he was put on in that, I think, in that left, that sort of like left wing position, the left attack position. But he just kept on drifting into midfield. And he wanted the ball so badly. And I felt like, you know, he had sort of 25 minutes to make an impact. And he was so desperate to try and make an impact. We were overplaying it.
Yeah.
And I think that just fell into Scotland's hands. I think Gareth Southgate making like-for-like substitutions is not a great sort of, it's not a good trait of a coach that's got tactical nous and, you know, can sort of like pick apart the opposition's tactics, basically. And I think if he just keeps on making like-for-like substitutions, it's not going to work. You have to change the system sometimes if it isn't working. I mean, sometimes you can't try and fit. You know, if you've started off and you're trying to fit squares in round holes, you can't keep on trying to put squares in round holes. You have to try and shift it somehow. And I don't think he did that against Scotland.
Well, especially if it's 0-0. Like, what are you trying to accomplish? With bringing Grealish on like that, I think it really, and especially as you said, when you compare it to the Czech Republic game where he started, like, England looked a different team with him starting, and especially with Saka on the opposite wing, with Mason Mount possibly contracting COVID-19 due to a sustained interaction with Billy Gilmour in the tunnel after the Scotland game.
Who had a great game, by the way, for Scotland.
My God, did you see Graeme Souness? First time I've seen him smile in purring. 20 years of punditry. He was just, oh my God, the cat that got the cream. He was making me feel sick. But I think with Grealish starting and Saka starting, England looked like a real threat. And even with Harry Kane not quite reproducing his club form that's made him the speculations of some big money moves in the summer, I think you've got two dangerous players there. And I think Germany, if they sleep, they'll come undone at their hands.
It had a lot of similarities with the Scotland game, I think, the Czech Republic game, with the exception that we actually got the goal early on. You know, I think in that Scotland game, we were pretty good from the offset. I think we started really sharp, started really lively. But then, you know, Scotland came back into it with their own chances. Obviously, after that John Stones header, free header, which he should have done better with.
Yeah, he should have buried it.
You know, it came right off the post. But, you know, I think early in the sort of Czech Republic game, Luke Shaw, you know, he had a sort of whipped ball over the sort of Czech right back over his head, and then Sterling through and hit the post again, same post. And then, you know, sort of pick for distribution. I think he looked brilliant. You know, he's sort of kicking. He's throwing. He was on the front foot. I think he's been the biggest surprise for me, is how good Pickford's been so far.
Well, I like seeing him bollock the defenders as well. I love it when I see a keeper just going mad at him. When also he's performing, it's not as if he's doing the Chesney and bollocking everyone and just letting the ball through his hands every time. He's actually leading by example. I don't want to compare him to Schmeichel, because Kasper Schmeichel's the next level as a goalkeeper, but Pickford's definitely been looking solid. And equally, the fullbacks for that game, Kyle Walker and Luke Shaw, I think you do not mess with them again. Leave them where they are and let them do exactly what they did, because in the first half, Luke Shaw especially, he was phenomenal.
Yeah,
and he's 25, he's been around for years. I couldn't believe it when I heard that. And, you know, when you see the fullbacks going all the way to the top and closing down the goalkeeper, and then it sparks everyone else into life. It was the first half against Czech Republic. England were as competent, as solid, as confident as I've seen them in a long time.
Yeah, and I think obviously with Harry Maguire coming in as well, I felt sorry for Tyrone Mings, because I think he had two very, very good performances in the first two group games. But him coming in, I think, just added an extra element in terms of like picking a pass. There was one where I think he picked it through to Kane. And, you know, obviously the movement around the ball was really, really important as well. I think Saka and Grealish definitely contributed to that. But that just created space for him. And he just sees a pass a little bit better than Mings does. I think he's on the same kind of level as John Stones, that. But it was impressive to see him back in then. It's hard to see how Mings gets back into that team now.
Maguire does carry the ball as well if he needs to. If he sees a lane through the middle of the park, he will go all the way up to the opposing box, which is something Mings never does really. I mean, obviously the trade-off is when he does attack like that, he can get caught on the turn. And if there's a team good enough, quick enough on the counter-attack, then England are going to be left in a lot of trouble. And that is the concern there. So maybe Southgate's shown his willingness to kind of, maybe not during the game, but the team that he sets out, he's willing to change a little bit considering the threat that's heading. So I don't know, I think there is room for manoeuvre there. I say leave the fullbacks where they are though, because they were tremendous.
Yeah, and what do you make of like Kane? He seems to be dropping deeper and deeper to try and get involved in the game. I don't know if it's a confidence thing and whether he's overthinking what he's doing. I know he drops deep for Tottenham to try and receive the ball, and he likes to play those sort of like big diagonals out into the wide position and then sort of like make his way towards the box. But at times, he was picking up the ball almost in the left-back position. He was going so, so deep. Do you think that is a confidence thing?
I don't think he ends up there unless he's got some kind of directive. He's been hugging the touchline. He's been in the middle of the park, as you say, very deep in his own half. He seems to me to be given the instructions to tie everything together. It's quite puzzling, really, considering how lethal he is in front of goal. To me, he looks a bit heavy as well. I don't know if he sustained an injury or he's had some kind of issue pre-tournament, but he does look a little bit heavy. He does look a little bit slower than usual. Maybe that's just my perception. Maybe I'm just seeing him not reach the lofty standards that he's produced in the past, but there's definitely something off there. And, you know, when he's forcing it, similar to when Grealish came on, you can see it when he's forcing it. And he wants to move the play forward. He wants to play that pass and get running, but it's just not quite there. And I'm not sure what to make of it, really. But he is the figurehead. I mean, who would you drop him altogether for Rashford? Because, like, I've been saying that, but then Rashford's come on and not looked that good himself. So what's the alternative?
Dominic Calvert-Lewin, that would be the alternative. Yeah. Obviously, he just doesn't look sharp to me. He does look, he looks knackered, man. He looks like a guy that's played a 60-game season, do you know what I mean? For the last 8 years. You know, because he, yeah. he has... Yeah. Rooney did the same, man. Rooney lost his sharpness. And we spoke about this. What happened to Rooney? He moved from that sort of nine position and he ended up just being a holding midfielder and then eventually playing for Derby, like a centre-back, basically. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like that quarterback position.
Yeah.
And I could see Kane doing something similar as well because obviously he's, what, 28, 29?
So I think he's 27.
So he's still got a long time left in that position. Yeah. But, for me, he just looks extremely tired and he could have rested him against Czech Republic. Nobody would have thought, right, oh, we're dropping our talisman. Like, we're dropping our star player. It just would have been, give him a rest, man. Give him a rest. Put someone else in there. Give someone else a chance. Give Dominic Calvert-Lewin a chance or give Rashford a chance because he's not really had the minutes. And, you know, I think we would have been better off from it. But it's obviously Southgate, you know, wants to sort of stick to his guns and wants to, you know, sort of give him more confidence. But
that would have been the perfect game because England had already qualified before the first whistle.
Exactly.
So that is when you can tick a load of boxes there. You can either give Rashford more minutes and get his confidence up because for me, he's absolutely lethal. I know he's not going through the best spell at United this season and now for England, but honestly, he's a proper striker as far as I can tell. Dominic Calvert-Lewin, another option. He's been lethal for Everton this season, Do you know what I mean? So why don't you start that guy, get him playing his brand of football? Obviously, you see what the rest of the team does there. If he's just playing pure striker, then what does the rest of the team do? Then you'd probably need an extra midfielder to break from that holding position. You know, it changes things a little bit.
I think so. I think Dominic Calvert-Lewin, he wouldn't be dropping deep and sort of receiving the ball in the areas that Kane does. So I think, you know, having Calvert-Lewin there, I think would definitely be like an out-and-out target, man. So, and he's lethal in the air, man. Such a physical presence and he's quick as well. So I think that would have been a good option. But, you know, obviously, you know, we always say like, you know, this is what the manager should have done. And like, there's a million things that fans are throwing at, or like different suggestions that Southgate could have done. But at the end of the day, he's got in charge. He's the one that's got all his coaching badges. So we'll leave it up to him. So, I mean, let's talk about Saka as well. Like, I know we've briefly touched on about how good he was, but man of the match performance, took his shirt off even though he didn't get a goal or an assist, which I thought was hilarious. Fair play to him. But he was very, very heavily involved in that goal. So obviously he came short, you know, playing in between the lines, turning with the ball and driving into the space, something that him and Grealish had done that really missed in those first two games. So obviously then he sort of like got to the byline. I think he had a 1-2 with Walker, was it? Put the ball across and then eventually Grealish put it back across for Sterling, but it was his run as well that drew the sort of player towards, you know, towards the middle of the goal, and then obviously Sterling was there to nod in. But you sort of like, I think you were probably like half jokingly, half serious saying start Saka, and then I was really surprised to see when he did start. And then I was even more surprised to see how good he was. Obviously, I haven't really seen much of him. You've probably watched more of Saka this season. Were you surprised at like how good he was?
Well, I've got to point out my own comments in previous episodes where I was actually a little bit dismissive of Saka's chances in the team. I said to you, would you pin your hopes on this kid? Because I wouldn't. And it's like, it makes sense, really. He's an energetic youngster who's willing. I mean, that Czech Republic left-back did not know what to do with him. Every time he would stop, he'd either stop dead and start doing his little bits, then misdirect, then he drives, or he moves at pace, constantly moving, wriggling from side to side, stepping over, all these options, all these attacking threats, always willing to cross the ball, or he can cut inside, equally competent on both sides. I've got to say, I was surprised, but he has been showing good form for Arsenal all year, but you never know how that's going to translate into the team, because club football, even with Arsenal being basically a mid-table side, it is a different style of football. You never know how people are going to adapt. I'm really, really impressed with him. And I'm happy for him, man, because this is only going to add confidence. This is only going to lift him up.
And so the second half, we'll move on to the second half. So obviously England, Southgate subbed in Henderson. I think we looked to build a little bit more, I mean, through him. The guy is a commanding midfield. You can see that the players respect him. And obviously he's always barking orders. You know, definitely not fit. But still an extremely good addition. Do you see him perhaps starting against Germany now that he's had 45 minutes under his belt?
Who would you put him with? Declan Rice?
Potentially, yeah. And maybe play Calvin Phillips in a more advanced position.
See, I think that midfield... He gives that longer passing scope, doesn't he? Because Declan Rice, he cleans up well, but he's not pinging in those mad over-the-top passes. He's not switching the play similar to Calvin Phillips. I don't like the look of that midfield because it seems a bit static and compact. I feel like that midfield gets overrun a little bit. I could be wrong. Maybe the extra defensive... Maybe the two defensive players in Rice and Phillips enable Henderson to have a little bit of extra freedom and to look for players like Saka and Grealish if they do play, you know, fingers crossed. But 45 minutes in a tournament.
Yeah, it's still not enough, is it? Yeah. 45 minutes since February. Obviously, I think he had 45 minutes in that friendly against Poland, was it? Or someone
and he could have had a goal. He had a goal this year, was it? Yeah, he's showing his willingness to get forward. But, you know, I've said it before, maybe a rest is, you know, as good as a break.
I think I could see him...
That doesn't make any sense, is it? Rest is a good break. They're the same thing.
So I could see him and Rice potentially as the holders. Because it looks like he's going to... I don't think he's going to tweak much tactically. So potentially they're the two holders. Maybe put Grealish in the sort of 10 position, you know, in the hole behind Kane. And then he'll probably go with... Sterling. I can't see him dropping
You've got to keep Sterling, yeah. Man. I couldn't believe how isolated he was in that Czech Republic game. Yeah. Harry Kane's just like forgetting he existed. Loads of time. You could see he was flipping. Think about it, man. I know we could have had 3, 4, 5, 6 goals. We've hit the woodwork in every game. But Sterling is the only one who's scoring. Give him the ball. Do you know what I mean? I'm not some mad Man City fan. I'm not a mad Sterling fan. But just... This is what's been going on. Give him the ball, man. He's obviously the only one who's getting himself into the positions to put it in the back of the net. So why ignore him? I saw outbursts of friction between them in that Czech Republic game. It was quite interesting, really.
And it's classic England like fandom, really, because I've seen so many people slating Sterling, and it's just like he's the guy that scored our only 2 goals of the tournament. That has to bear some weight, man. And he was very, very close to getting a third in that Czech Republic game. So. I can understand why Southgate's sticking with him, to be honest. So, obviously, you know, Saka pointed great performance. I don't think he'd be in contention to start against Germany. Sancho's had 5 minutes. Are you shocked that he didn't get more time against Czech Republic?
Not really, because we've touched on it so many times. Southgate does have his favourites, doesn't he? And he ain't one of them. So it doesn't really surprise me. I mean, Grealish... He's not one of Southgate's boys. Look at it's taken a national outcry for him to get a start. Do you know what I mean? So it doesn't really surprise me. I mean, do you think if Sancho is included into the team, how does he improve England against Germany if he does start?
Yeah, I mean, I think he'd do something similar to what Saka did. I think you know, he can sort of play all around the pitch. He likes to pick the ball up in those sort of like half spaces in between the opponent's lines, defensive lines. You know, he can score from outside the box. You know, he can get into good positions inside the box. I think he had something like 12 goals, 8 assists, or the other way around for Borussia Dortmund this season. Albeit Southgate kind of intonated that the Bundesliga wasn't the same level as the Premier League, which I thought was quite strange to say. Kind of like, almost like taking the shine away of what Sancho's achieved this season. I mean, he's only like, what, 20, 21? There's talks about him going to United for like 100 million or something.
That's unlike Southgate as well, to say like that. Usually he's quite encouraging. Usually he protects the players at all costs. But that just highlights what we're talking about. He does have his favourites, man. And it's similar kind of area. But Jude Bellingham... He didn't impress me that much when he played. Maybe it's similar to Jack Grealish, where you should start him and he's a whole different player when you start him. But I wasn't that blown away by him. And maybe Sancho has a similar effect on the training field for Southgate. You never know what's going on behind closed doors. I mean, it's easy to pick your fantasy team, isn't it? But he might be seeing something. I mean, he certainly is seeing something that we're not.
And, you know, I think we certainly lacked a lot of attacking presence. I think we created, or I read that we created 0 expected goals in the second half, which essentially means we didn't create a chance. Obviously, we topped the group conceding 0 goals, which is, you know, defensively we can be happy about that. But in terms of creating chances, we've been pretty average overall, I would say. So it's tough to see how these performances so far can give anyone confidence going into a game against Portugal, France or Germany. And as we know, it's going to be the Germans. Like, can you realistically see how we get a win from that game?
Yes.
Just defensively? Just by being stout defensively?
I think if you're not conceding goals, you're halfway there. And Germany don't look watertight at the back themselves. So if Southgate can make those little tweaks, those little changes, and make some brave team choices. I mean, come on. You can't... you can't ignore what Saka and Grealish have done. If they don't start, I don't know what he's playing at. Do you know what I mean? I do not know what he's playing at if they don't start. We're going to see what he gets up to. I think he's quite conservative by nature, and I think we are going to see some disappointingly safe choices, but you are going to have to do something to turn over even an average German team, so we'll see.
So obviously that game's next Tuesday, so do you think that perhaps Germany have a more sort of like a higher press than England, so it'll be a different sort of tactical conundrum for Southgate to work out, because I don't think we're going to have like, we're not going to have like 60-65% possession of what we've had in these sort of other games. We're not going to really have a chance to dominate the ball, because I think they're going to put us under a lot more pressure. I don't think England play very well when they try and build. Like, we've never really been a sort of like really penetrative building side, and as we said, like, yeah, we're trying to keep the ball, but it's more sort of possession for the sake of it. It's not possession with penetration. So I wonder if us being a little bit more direct might actually help us.
I think definitely would, because especially with some of the pace we've got in the team, we've got some rapid players, man. And if they can figure out a way to release those players at the right time, especially inside your own half, man, on the break, I would back a lot of England players and a lot of counter-attacks to get through. But it's all about, you have to be cutthroat, don't you, if you're playing counter-attacking football at this level.
Has to be clinical. Yeah.
And England haven't been playing that way, or at least they haven't showed in games that they know how to do that. So that'd be a gamble in itself.
Yeah, because we haven't come up against teams that's allowed us to, you know, play on the counter. So I think coming against a German side that are going to look to probably, you know, dominate possession. And as we said about the Germans, no matter like whether they're in form or out of form, they've always got a chance in the knockout stages. I think us being able to play on the break might actually suit us, man, with the pace in those wide areas. But we have to have Kane not dropping. He can't be dropping in to receive the ball. And I don't think he'll be doing that as much against Germany. Hopefully, we'll stay quite high. Just stay on the last two centre-backs and just cause them problems. Allow sort of like more space for the wide areas, the wide players such as Saka, Grealish, you know, Sterling, whoever it's going to be in those sort of like pockets of space. Let them pick up the ball. Let them drive at players one-on-one. Let them drive at people like Matt Tummels, man. Because like obviously getting older, not got the pace that he used to have. And we never really had a lot of pace. But, you know, if we can get Sterling isolated with them sort of players, you know, potentially got a chance.
Sterling running at Hummels, I know what I'd be betting on in that race, man. 100%. I'm getting excited now.
You never know.
I think England have got a decent chance, and I am not the most optimistic person in the world when it comes to anything, least of all England's chances at tournament football. But what does concern me is consistently England have shown a habit of dropping off in the second half, and Germany are more than capable of turning the screw in the last 20 minutes. So,
and I think they were great against Portugal.
Oh, they were ruthless, man. Yeah, they looked like a proper Germany team, even if it was just for 45 minutes. And you can see the damage they've done against a very, very good Portugal side.
Right, so we're just going to have a roundup of all the Euro games and all the groups, how they finished and what our predictor looked like. We did well with some groups and not so well with others.
You've been very generous to us. I think we picked some pretty safe bets for some of the groups. But, you know, this tournament has thrown up some mad results, hasn't it?
So Italy looked increasingly impressive with 3-0 and 1-0 wins over Switzerland and Wales, respectively. Wales squeaked through in second place on goal difference after defeating Turkey 2-0 and could have grabbed a point against Italy had it not been for their red card and the Gareth Bale missing a sitter. So Switzerland also worked Turkey over, winning 3-1 in a game full of absolute bangers. Jordan Shaqiri, I swear to God, man, like he turns it on during international football. Like, he really, really turns it on. It's a shame that I said ages, he's the sort of player that Arsenal should be looking at.
Yeah.
You know, even, he's still at Liverpool now. But he's kind of like proper off the boil there, isn't he?
I don't know. How long did he spend at Stoke? Do you know what I mean? He's a bit of a mad one at club level. You never know really what you're going to get with him, but he was letting loose in that game. And I think all the players were just thinking, right, let's just have shots outside the box, which is something players seem to be a little bit hesitant to do in this tournament for some reason. And the Turkish players' goal, that was ridiculous. That was some FIFA 14 stuff, man.
So that was enough to ensure that they booked a place in the last 16, coming in third. Wales were gone to play Denmark, and the Swiss have a daunting test ahead of them after drawing France. So Italy have now gone 30 games undefeated under Mancini, and it equals their all-time record set under Pozzo in the 1930s, I think, where they won 2 World Cups. So gone over 1,000 minutes without conceding goal. Now that's a team.
That's a proper team. And I remember seeing them beat Switzerland in the opening game, didn't they? Was it 3-0?
Yes.
Yeah, so I remember watching them and thinking, all right, they've won 3-0, but this is not that impressive. No, they beat Turkey in the opening game, didn't they?
It was Turkey 3-0, yeah, because it was a 0-0 at half-time, wasn't it? And then they just turned it on.
And I just thought, oh, these aren't that good. But in the next game against Switzerland, they looked unbelievable. And against Wales, I think that game showed how good Wales actually are.
And that was Italy's B team, though, to be fair. Like, you know what I mean? They made loads of changes.
To be fair, that's a fair point. And Wales were, like, full strength. So, yeah. But it's good. It's a good sign for Wales going forward. I think you've got to back Italy as a real contender for this tournament.
Yeah, so we got our forecast correct on that one. Last two the wrong way round, but a shocking dark horse prediction by me, to be honest.
You're not the only person I've seen do that, though. A lot of people online have said, what has happened to Turkey? Like, I don't think you're alone. A little arm around your shoulder there, a consolation.
Yeah, it made a lot of sense, but it's definitely about 50 quid down the drain for me. So, so Group B, so as expected, Belgium topped the group with 9 points. Thrilling pair of final group games dragged a Denmark team who had lost both opening games into the last 16. And I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure this is the first time it's ever happened in the Euros. Obviously, losing the first two games, you know, prior to 2016 would have meant that there was almost no chance that you were going to go through. But I guess this is the first time it's happened in the Euros. Maybe I'm wrong. But still impressive after those two defeats to come out against Russia and beat them 4-1. And they looked at the last 20 minutes, that proper ramped up their goal difference in that sort of late flurry. But Belgium looked really, really strong against Finland again. I think they were strong against Denmark after Denmark outplayed them first half, didn't they? Completely outplayed them.
They came out at 100 miles an hour. And I think you can't discount the emotional impetus that was behind them in that game. After the disappointing Finland result and after that tragic occurrence with Christian Eriksen, I think they were free. They were free of all pressure and they thought, let's just put our foot down here and see what happens. And they were rewarded in the first half. I mean, Belgium, they looked shell-shocked for a lot of that game. But to be honest, I had an inkling that they couldn't keep up that pace, Denmark. And I thought, once this slows down, Belgium are going to take over. And that's actually what happened. One of the few correct predictions on my part for this tournament.
I mean, it helps when you can bring on Kevin De Bruyne and Eden Hazard, doesn't it?
It does help, to be fair.
You know what I mean?
You've got that in your locker. And, you know, De Bruyne scoring and assisting to straight away come on. You see what type of quality he is, as if he was in any doubt already.
Yeah, what a footballer. Like, easily in the top five footballers on the planet right now, if not in the top three.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, Belgium, they'll be sort of like less pleased about their draw in the last 16. They got to play Portugal. Imagine topping your group, getting 9 points, and having to play Portugal in the last 16. So our predictor on that one, forecast correct again. So we've got another forecast, and then Russia and Finland all the way around. So top two we got right. Group C, this predictor was terrible on this one. I only got Macedonia right, bottom of the table, that was it. So obviously this one, I don't think we really expected the Dutch to be as good as they have been, but, you know, they topped the group in style. 3 wins, 9 points, and a plus 6 goal difference. They looked fairly comfortable, aside from letting a 2-0 lead slip when Ukraine scored 2 quick second half goals. And I think it was a great goal from Yarmolenko, but their lead was restored with a Denzel Dumfries goal. So at least something related to Scotland's got through to the last 16. So a player, you know, he's certainly emerging as a contender for, like, player of the tournament for me so far. Like, I think he's got 2 goals from right back. I think he's had a couple of definitely 1 man of the match performance, if not 2. Obviously, Austria joined them in the knockout stages in second place to play a tough game against Italy, which is, you know, a very daunting prospect for them. And Ukraine sneaked through as the last best placed third. And they play Sweden, which I'm sure they're going to be absolutely buzzing.
Yeah,
you know, the basically the worst team out of the group stage, you sneak through and you get to play Sweden.
But Sweden, man, they're very workmanlike, very, what's the best way to say it? They're
industrious.
Industrious, very underwhelming, but somehow churning out results. I don't know what's going on here. Sweden,
Marcus Berg and Seb Larsson, like players that you thought were like a bygone of football, do you know what I mean? And they're still there, still like knocking out good performances for their national team. And obviously they've got Isak.
Yeah, who doesn't know who Gary Lineker is, which is hilarious.
Yeah, but he nearly scored like the best goal you will ever see at Euros. Against, I can't remember who's over the first or second one, but like I'll find it for you later. In a run that was, they ended up with the keeper saving to his right hand side, but he just beat about 3 players. What a great player he is.
Good lad.
I think he's going to be a very, very good player, and I think Dortmund have got a little buyback clause on him from Sociedad, I think.
Yeah, nice, that'll do. Yeah,
so, 25 mil, there you go.
We'll sell him to you, but we might have him back in a few seasons.
Yeah. I love those buyback clauses. Right, so Group D, predictor, all wrong. Every single team in a different position.
There's always a chance of this in the England group, weren't there, really? I mean, you're always trying to hedge your bets. You don't want to let your patriotism overcome you. But we couldn't have got it more wrong, I don't think.
Nah, I think, you know, England made comfortable work at the end of Group D after topping the group 7 points, albeit only managing 2 goals, both of which Raheem Sterling scored. So, obviously, we spoke about this before, but clean sheets would be the positives that Southgate would take out of the games. But coming up against the Germans in the first knockout phase will be a completely different challenge for us. Both Croatia and Czech Republic joined England in the last 16. So Croatia finished the group in second on goals scored, but find themselves on the extremely tough side of the draw, playing Spain and with France, Portugal, Belgium and Italy all to contend with if they want to make it to the final. So
that's rough.
So old Luka Modric has got a big task on his hand. And did you see his goal against Scotland?
I did, yeah.
Outside of the right boot.
Nice.
Oh, filthy. Still got it at the highest level.
Charisma stays.
Yeah, so Czech Republic will face the informed Dutch side who, to a lot of people, will have been a surprise strong team in the tournament. So when looking back on it, yes, Scotland bottom made sense. England top made sense. So did we ever really expect Scotland to go through? It's easy saying it in hindsight, but I think they probably deserved more than they got, don't you think?
Yeah, they were unfortunate in the Czech Republic game. They created a lot of chances and, you know, got beat by an absolute worldie. And just unfortunate breaks all around the pitch. It's difficult to say you could have seen that coming. I think on a different day, but it's all shoulda, woulda, coulda, isn't it? Everyone's got the results they deserve. A lot of things can happen in a football game and you got to mitigate and you got to plan for all those things. And they weren't good enough. And, you know, there's plenty of opportunities to go through. Best third place finishers. It's not as if there wasn't a wider net this time. So what can you say?
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously we use expected goals as a sort of a good metric to measure a sort of what chances a team creates, but perhaps they're lacking in sort of like putting the ball in the net. And I think they had about 5.5. So they were expected to score 5.5 goals based on the chances they created. And obviously they only got one.
Yeah.
So that shows you that they were really missing somebody to put the ball in the net. And we thought Shadams might be that player. Do you know what I mean? So, but unfortunately, you know, he had his chances, but didn't really manage to take any. So yeah, Group E. So yeah, we got this one completely wrong as well. Who expected Sweden to top that group?
This makes me cringe in terms of like, how could you possibly get this predictor correct? What were we doing trying to do the whole tournament tree? What? How ambitious is that? But yeah, certainly not Sweden with the old boys in tow. And Spain for me, looking, I know they absolutely hammered Slovakia the other day, but I still don't think they look that good.
Really?
I really don't think they look that good.
I think they're just starting to warm up basically. And obviously they had a couple of own goals from that lacklustre Slovakia team. Like, I don't know how they beat Poland 2-1. And, you know, Spain, like, they've started that campaign. They've just been really, really wasteful. Obviously missing 5 international penalties in a row, which is crazy. And the second one for the tournament, obviously Moreno's missed one. And then Alvaro Morata, who's getting a lot of stick on social media for being just like, you know, completely wasteful.
Yeah, no good. Yeah, basically. Just being
not very good. Yeah, so, but, you know, he's still getting picked by Luis Enrique. He's putting a lot of trust in him. So, obviously, a valiant fight back from the Poles was enough to put them through to knockout stages after they went 2-0 down against Sweden. Obviously, they lost to Slovakia in that first game, had a respectful 0-0 draw, but were down 2-0 because of those two fantastic Emil Forsberg goals. So, it looks a really, really good player. But even Ballon d'Or winner Robert Lewandowski couldn't drag them out of the mire. And they ended up losing 3-2. So, you know, he also managed to miss one of the sitters of the tournament. Did you see this? The one where he hit the crossbar twice in 2 seconds or whatever.
Yeah, and again, hate to bring up the FIFA references, but it was one of those things where the algorithm of the game completely like does you over. But Lewandowski is similar to Harry Kane in that he's playing a different role for his country. He's dragging in deeper. He's going out wider. He's almost trying to drag other players along with him. Although I would say the difference in quality between him and the rest of his teammates is significantly larger than it would be between Kane and the rest of his teammates. So yeah, he has scored a good few goals. He did everything he could for his country. But you know, Poland missing a few key midfielders and that service isn't going to be as good to the top man. And they were really disappointing for me overall as well.
Yeah, extremely reliant on Lewandowski, aren't they? So yes. It's a big problem. I think they're going to need to solve that once he retires. Perhaps he's got sort of the World Cup next year in him. Could you see him again there again at the Euros? I'm not out like 38. I doubt it. So, I mean, Sweden, like I'd say one of the biggest overachievers like in the whole of this year's Euros. Definitely topping the table with 7 points. You know, looking like a strong side, and they're not a team that you really want to play at the minute, are they? You don't want to play a team in form, no matter who they are.
Yeah, especially when you go into the game with the idea of, oh, these guys aren't that good. and then they're just playing their own game, even if it's underwhelming.
Yeah.
And they can, you know what I mean? You're not going to, like Ukraine need to cross the T's and dot their I's in that game, because they could easily get turned over there by Sweden. Absolutely.
All right, and then move on to the group of F. So obviously France topped the group, 5 points, and we always knew this was going to be super competitive. Germany took second on goal scored after finishing on 4 points along with Portugal with the same goal difference. So Hungary were possibly one of the bigger overachievers in the tournament as well. Like they held Portugal for 80 minutes. It was 0-0, and then obviously it ended up being 3-0 after, you know, they sort of just like broke them down. It's kind of like the mental resolve went and conceded like three late goals. But then they held France and Germany to draws. And I think, you know, if there was going to be sort of anyone getting a place in the last 16 on merit, like, it should have been them, really. It was really, really unfortunate for them, man.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I used the phrase, whipping boys, and they were not that at all. Like, Portugal, once the floodgates opened, they were really fortunate to get those three goals, and that was such a flattering result for them. France looked like they didn't know what to do with them. You know what I mean? And Germany, they had to claw back a goal twice just to put level with them. So it's not like Hungary were just sitting back and putting 11 behind the ball either. They were threatening. So yeah, it's really unfortunate for the Hungarians.
And I think one thing that this, you know, best third place playoff teams, like the four of the best third place teams going through to the last 16, I think it does create a lot of drama in these last group games, doesn't it? Like obviously both being played at the same time. You know, if you've got sort of two games, like one game on each screen, and there's also the sort of like, you know, the championship playoff race thing that they do, you know, sort of the Soccer Saturday thing. Oh, we're going to go to the other game. Like, there's been another goal. There was kind of that excitement. I think it was really cool because they showed the German equaliser, the first one. And then, like, they kept on. It was like, and they didn't let it slip. And they were like, but then this happened, you know what I mean? Yeah. And then immediately after, like, Hungary scored, and it was just like, oh, it was like, sick.
Yesterday was ridiculous. One of the most entertaining evenings of football I've seen in a long time, because, you know, so much quality on the pitch. And you know, when France and Portugal, they were playing. They weren't sitting back. They weren't trying to be comfortable. They were playing, man. And to see top quality players like that. Let's talk about the penalties, though.
Yeah, I think we've got to. Like, there's a few things that we want to talk about in that. So, I mean, the penalties, the first one, I initially thought it might be a little bit harsh on the keeper, but after looking back on it, he did not win the ball and he nearly knocked the geezer's head off.
He absolutely clattered him. Yeah, absolutely a penalty. But that the Kylian Mbappe one, no chance.
I don't know how that's gone to VAR and they've still gave it. Yeah, so what the VAR would usually do is, if there's been a clear and obvious error from the referee, then they would indicate to the ref that he should go and look at the monitor, but they didn't do that, so they didn't think that the referee meant error. But what does, I think it was Semedo, the Portuguese, I think right back, what do you want him to do? Like, literally, he's tracked Mbappe, who's one of the quickest players on the planet, the most lethal in the box, tracked him all the way, like gone shoulder to shoulder, and Mbappe's like fell down in a heap. What more does he do?
Well, he should have got out of the way, really, and let him score a goal, which is basically what the rules are telling you to do, because if there's that was minimal contact, minimal, and it's not as if that's been given the whole tournament. There's a clear inconsistency in how these things are being judged. So, you know, sometimes a defender can send an attacker sprawling and nothing happens, and other times like this, coincidentally enough, with a really high-profile player playing for a really high-profile team, I don't think that's an accident at all. So, I don't think we're going to get consistency established in this tournament. But yeah, that was no way. That was a penalty. But it added drama to the game, so I was happy enough.
Yeah, I think that's mainly what UEFA are hoping for, isn't it? They want drama and they want the big teams in the sort of like last 16, don't they? And with this being a draw, so that penalty taking it to a tie. And then there was one right at the end with France. And I think if France would have scored, I think there was still potential that Portugal wouldn't have gone through, because if Hungary would have scored or Germany wouldn't have scored, then, you know, the best result for both France and Portugal was a draw, really.
And I think that one at the end was a penalty.
100%. Like, way more of a penalty than the Mbappe one.
He had his hand on his shirt, and they jostled until they got into the very, like, a really tight corner in the penalty area, right by the byline.
I think he scraped his heel or something,
yeah.
Didn't he?
There was, like, two fouls going on there, and he was definitely inside the box. So I don't know why you give the Mbappe one and you don't give that one, like. It's a bit weird,
yeah. It didn't even get looked at, I don't think. So I just think it's all a bit strange, really. I'm not sure if the VAR is actually solving problems or creating it, and we've spoke about that before. But great entertainment, as you said, like both games, and I think that group all over. You know, even the 4-2, the 4-2 Germany Portugal game, that was really, really good to watch. And Hungary, fair play to them, man. Like, you can't take anything away from them.
did they have just a one-off, like, great tournament, or are they actually, like, a decent team? I've never seen much of them, to be fair. I don't really know where they stand in the overall picture. Yeah, Hungary, it's a shame. In a different group, they would have had better results. But, you know, that was... I couldn't believe Germany was sitting bottom of the group for most of the games yesterday. And it's like, you never see that, do you?
Yeah,
I can't remember ever seeing that again.
Portugal, with what we mentioned earlier, Portugal were in every place of the group at some point in that 90 minutes yesterday. So that showed you the group of death it was. You know what I mean? It really did turn out to be that way. All right, so I think that's it for the footy stuff. Obviously, an extended bit for this week. Obviously, as you know, as always with Euros, when it's going to be, we've got a lot of conversation about that. We're going to move on to combat sports stuff, which was a very entertaining weekend of fights, wasn't it? So we're going to move on to that.
So on to the combat sports section for this week, and a very entertaining weekend at the fights has just passed us by. So I'll begin with Noye Inoue defending his super bantamweight titles with a third round knockout over Michael Dasmarinas. There was a look of disbelief on Dasmarinas' face whenever Inoue landed clean. Inoue dropped him in the second with a left hook to the body. The same shot dropped him again in the third, and Dasmarinas barely answered the count. Seconds later, Inoue sunk in yet another left hook to the body, erasing the last of Dasmarinas' resolve and adding yet another title defence to his ledger. Dasmarinas didn't belong in there with him, but the same could be said for every one of Inoue's previous opponents except for the great Nonito Donaire. In Houston, Texas, on that same night, Jamal Charlo repelled the spirited and durable Juan Macias Montiel to keep his middleweight belt and move his record to 32-0. And these two punched holes in each other for 12 rounds, and I highly recommend it for anyone who's got an hour to kill. Montiel's a former welterweight, making his effort even more impressive. Before losing to Charlo, his last loss came down at 147 pounds against Jaime Munguia, who HBO were touting as the next credible opponent for Gennady Golovkin before they retreated from the boxing world after decades of broadcasting the sport. Now, at the same time as Montiel fought Charlo in Houston, that very same Jaime Munguia fought Camel Zemereta in El Paso, a Hispanic hotbed of southern Texas right on the US-Mexico border. Zemereta had 5 KOs in 22 outings going into this one, so it was a relatively low-risk fight on paper for the volume-punching Munguia. He was also coming off a 7-round retirement loss to the aforementioned Golovkin, and took this fight on 2 weeks' notice, so the deck was stacked in Munguia's favour in every possible way. Zemereta took his beating bravely. Munguia was too big, punched with too much variety and with too much volume, and the referee halted the contest with Zemereta on his stool at the end of the 6th round.
So just to go back to, he's Japanese, Inoue, right?
He's
so undefeated.
Undefeated.
So what's next for him?
He is looking as if he's far and away out on his own in the super bantamweight division. He's moved up from, I think he went fly, super fly, and then bantamweight, and then super bantam. So I think he's a 3-weight world champion at this point. 20 or so fights, 28 years old. And he's one of those guys where he hits people and they look like, what has just happened? He's a next fighter. He's a completely different brand. He's so fast, so powerful, so incisive and brave. I heard an anecdote about him the other day. During his fight with Nonito Donaire, he broke his orbital bone, which was the same injury that made Billy Joe Saunders retire against Canelo Alvarez. And he didn't retire. Instead, to stop the double vision that resulted from the injury, he held his glove up over that eye so he could only see out of one eye and returned it to single vision and went on to win the fight. Nearly knocked out Donaire in the 8th or the 9th with the left hook to the body again.
That's mad intelligence. What an adjustment to make.
What a toughness and resolve and just willing to go through the fire. And that was... that was a hard, hard fight, technically, from both sides, amazing, but they were battering each other as well, and he's going to take some beating. Father Time, as he does, will only get all the best fighters in the end, and I think he's one of those guys, unless he moves up too many weight classes, which, you know, size, even the most rudimentary fighter, once they're big enough, can overcome the most talented little fighters.
I suppose that's huge for Asian boxing as well, though, isn't it?
Well, the Japanese, they do, they've got a massive New Year's Eve show every year. And they've got a litany of champions in the smaller weight classes that would compare with anything that the Americans, the British or the Europeans can offer up. It's just that we don't get exposed to it. The lighter weight classes are a little bit undesirable, but I don't see why. They should get hold of it. And Inoue should be promoted more and more and more and more. I can't get enough of him, to be honest. One more fight I caught wind of. The most random thing I've heard of, buried on an undercard in Guadalajara. Julio Cesar Chavez Jr. versus former UFC middleweight champion and bona fide legend Anderson Silva in an 8-round cruiserweight fight. Chavez Jr. continued his fine tradition of missing weight, forfeiting $100,000 to Silva before a punch was even thrown. Silva's 46 years old, by the way. Chavez Jr.'s 35, but was slower, plodding along, launching and missing with predictable swings. The fight went the distance with Silva exhibiting that playful, taunting style he showed us so many times in the cage. Chavez Jr. just looked bemused, which is quite puzzling for a former world champion with 58 professional fights under his belt. It's a lazy but inevitable comparison to make, but he, like so many other second-generation fighters, he just isn't a patch on his old man. Incidentally, the real Julio Cesar Chavez, now aged 58, had an exhibition bout with head guards against the 42-year-old son of deceased former opponent Hector Camacho on the same card. And I think that was in the main event slot as well, which just shows you how highly Chavez is still regarded in his home country.
Sounds like that wasn't the only thing being buried in Guadalajara that night, you know what I mean? Like, that's what a mad Mexican standoff. Like, what's going on here? Like, all these old geezers still mixing it.
And you know, I think before the final round, Julio Cesar Chavez took off his head guard. And he told his opponent to do the same thing. And his opponent wouldn't take it off. He said, I'm not continuing this. But he's a real man. And I think he was sleeping with Salma Hayek back in the day as well. So,
what a legend.
For the lads. And in the UFC, the Korean zombie Chan Sung Jung earns a unanimous 5-round decision victory despite a late surge from Daniel Ige. The zombie's timing was tuned in at the start, holding a static stance and using his superior speed to land strikes on the smaller Ige. His takedowns and ground control in the back were particularly impressive. Ige switched his attack to the body in the 4th and 5th rounds but couldn't stop the zombie from dragging him down and latching on that body triangle. A fair result and an entertaining fight. On that same card, Marlon Vera snatched a decision win over Davey Grant in a particularly grueling affair. MMA fans will remember Vera for his win over the heavily hyped Sugar Sean O'Malley, and he again showed his durability and meanness here, overcoming Grant's early explosions before bringing his knees and elbows into play to devastating effect for the unanimous decision win.
Was that Sean O'Malley's last time out?
No, he's fought since, and you know, I think it highlighted the importance of matchmaking for these highlight reel strikers. Against Vera, he just got dragged into a fight that wasn't his own. And when he's allowed to experiment and he's allowed that time, and when he has the size advantage and the mental edge on his opponent, O'Malley does look like a world beater. But I think it speaks volumes that they're not talking about that Vera rematch anytime soon. They want to pump every last dollar out of him. And I like O'Malley, I'm not cussing him. But I think, yeah, keep him away from Chico Vera. To wrap up results from last week, Rory McDonald suffered an unexpected 3-round decision loss to Gleison Tibau in the PFL. McDonald is still only 31 years old, which is amazing considering how long he's been a recognisable name in MMA. Tibau, now 37, is the only man to ever cast any aspersion on Khabib Nurmagomedov's reputation in their 2012 bout. McDonald was smooth as ever, threatening from every scenario. Clean footwork, jabs, teep kicks, single leg attempts, back takes, he can do it all. Unfortunately, he managed to poke Tibau in the eye 3 or 4 times during the evasive manoeuvres, and Tibau's right eye was a bruised mess by the end. Regardless, I had McDonald winning over the 3 rounds, and I don't know how, but 2 of the 3 judges scored the fight 29-28 to Tibau, which is outrageous. Maybe they could have given him the 3rd, but that is really, really spurious. That's being as generous as you can possibly be. McDonald was robbed blind there. He's a Hall of Famer for the UFC, and he's still 31. He's getting robbed in the PFL, so I don't know what's going on there. I think he needs to make some decisions about what he's going to do. Incidentally, the PFL have a strange league system. We've spoke often about that.
Yeah.
So this was to go on to like a championship or some kind of finale.
So like a promotion relegation. Oh, like a knockout. Is it like a knockout
thing? They're doing a constant season. So, and if you get finishes in the 1st round, you get so many points. If you get a finish in the 2nd round. So they're trying to innovate in terms of the rule set, but they need to sort out their officiating.
And talk about innovation, why don't you have a quick little mention about the one
championship are covering boxing. I don't know how this works or the intricacies of it, but they either held or co-promoted or just put the money up for Ringfiset Saw Rungvisai, the Thai champion who beat Roman Chocolatito Gonzalez twice, I think 3 or 4 years ago. Stunning knockouts, and he's since fought Estrada, and yeah, he's like the WBC flyweight champion, and he fought a Mexican lad anyway. I just caught the highlights just before I came over here to record. They got into a war, and I didn't know that ONE Championship were promoting this along with MMA, Thai boxing, kickboxing. They're going to do BJJ in the cage now. They're going to the next level, and it's interesting that they allowed the WBC to keep their their dominion over their belt. So it's not a one championship boxing thing. It's the WBC, but it's in one championship.
It's not like they're creating their own boxing categories or weights or anything like that. They're just kind of like essentially trying to steal some of the limelight, I suppose, from the sort of big boxing corporations that are now dominating with sort of like, you know, tying down boxers to long-term contracts. Is it going to be a case of like that's what they're going to try and do with one of the big names in boxing?
Well, if I was them, I'd be trying to do it. And they look like the kind of company who want to attract the best talent. So it's interesting that they let the WBC have any kind of say in that, because if the UFC went into boxing, I can't imagine them having a WBA, IBF, WBC title going on. It would be the UFC's boxing title. So it shows you that they're playing nice in order to get boxing in through the door. And maybe they understand the landscape a lot better than most people, because once fighters come to one and they get more coverage and possibly better paydays, then they can lock down and have their own championship and start to build from there, their own kind of legacy.
So would they essentially be, you know, exclusive to one championship boxing? So they would only be able to fight under their cards. They wouldn't be able to go and fight under... Because there isn't, you know, obviously with UFC and the one championship in the UFC, at the minute, you can't sort of compete in both, can you?
Well, nah, UFC...
Yeah, you have to leave one for the other contractually, yeah, I guess.
Exactly, and I think that would be the end goal, to have boxers exclusively fighting under one championship's banner. But this is, as far as I'm aware, that was the first ever boxing event at a one championship event. I don't know where it's going to go. But I'm really excited. If the quality of that first fight is anything to go by, we've got some bangers coming up, so I'm really excited.
I feel like you're halfway there to a promotional relegation league system there, man.
Yeah, maybe.
I feel like that would be so exciting if that was implemented, man. So, like, you know, you got 10 fighters all competing in, say, you know, the one championship boxing, and whoever's in the top three after, say, 10 fights or something would move up into like another league. I think that'd be awesome, man.
I think it'd be sweet, and it'd be a much better way, a fairer way to designate value and quality. Mm. You know, because there's so many top 10 rankings in boxing. Every sanctioning body's got their top 10. And the top fives are kind of the same, but if you're a champion for one organisation, you're not even going to feature in the top 10 for any of the others. So it's this massive pissing contest that really takes away from fan awareness. You want to promote the fighters, you want to know who's good, you want to know what type of fighters they are, who they've beat, all this kind of stuff, and all that politicking just stands in the way. But this has been a problem for years and years, and I don't see one's involvement clearing it up anytime soon.
Yeah, because I think in the sort of mixed martial arts world, there is kind of, I feel like anyway, that there's more focus on the sort of meritocracy, or actually beating the people that are ranked ahead of you, and then you get your chance at the title. Whereas I feel like in boxing, you can, as long as you've got the sort of like personality and you've got the clout and the promoters backing you can sort of like definitely spearhead your way up a sort of, you know, any kind of like belt title contention quite easily, just based on your personality and who you got backing you, rather than, you know, you might disagree, but for me, it kind of feels like in UFC, it's a kind of little bit more merit-based than it is in the boxing world.
I'd definitely agree with you. Now, that kind of star power does still work in the UFC. Now, there are certain popular fighters, again, Sugar Sean.
McGregor's the main, obviously, yeah. He's killed it. And even though, you know, he's not really sort of as competitive as he was, he's still like making... like extreme amounts of money.
Yeah, exactly. But even fighters like Sugar Sean O'Malley, if he didn't get beat by Vera and then carried on knocking out the last guy the way he did, I mean, you'd probably be looking at him in somewhere near the top five, when he really hasn't beat anyone on a consistent basis to justify that position. So there is that aspect of star quality, star power that does exist in the UFC, but it's way more prevalent in boxing. I do agree with you. Now, on to the scheduled fights for next week. From the UFC, we've got the Frenchman, Cyril Gagne, against Alexander Volkov. They're headlining the Fight Night card on the 26th. On Friday the 25th, Bellator 261 and PFL 6 will take place. The 26th is also going to be a very busy night at the boxing, with Vasyl Lomachenko coming back from his loss against Teofimo Lopez against Masayoshi Nakatani. I think I got that right. And he's the only other person to go the distance with Teofimo Lopez, so a nice bit of cross-promotion there. And £5 north at £140, we've got Gervonta Davis and Mario Barrios competing for some kind of version of a £140 title. Now, bear in mind, Scotsman Josh Taylor unified that division famously a good few weeks ago against Jose Ramirez, so how this is a world championship fight, I don't know. Well, I do know. They paid their sanctioning fees, and this just highlights the ridiculousness of it all. I would tune into this fight because Javante is he's outstanding talent, but he's a tiny guy. He's about 10 pounds heavier than he should be. It's the same old story, isn't it? This should be a good fight, and Mario Barrios is a lot bigger than him. By all accounts, he's quite durable, so he might take a bit of a pacing before he goes down. Again, on that same, this is what I mean, busy night of the boxing. Former unified light middleweight champion Hayson Rosario goes against Erickson Lubin in Atlanta. They've both lost to Charlo in the last 3 years. Brits Jose Burton and Paul Butler will also feature on Frank Warren's BT show on Friday the 25th. So we sprinted through that a little bit after an extended football section. Obviously, you got to give praise be to the Euros and all that. But yeah, I'm looking forward to the fights this weekend, and I'll give a fair enough account of everything next week.
Sounds exciting. Obviously, UFC's kind of had its not kind of dull weeks, but it's just sort of taken a couple of steps back for what it's been in the last sort of 2 months, because it's just been so intense every week.
Yeah, you can't put out those mega events every week. And also, Gagne and Volkov, that's a good fight, man.
Like, still big.
Really, yeah. Really good. And I think you're going to see Gagne moving towards the title pretty soon, because he's just an outstanding fighter, very mobile, very crisp technique. He doesn't seem to get rattled going the distance. Heavily muscled, knockout power, good submissions. I think he's the next one after Ngannou and them go. So we'll see.
Yeah, so we're going to have the review of all those fights next week on the Combat Sports section. We're also going to have the review of the England versus Germany game. So we'll be sort of going over that with a fine tooth comb.
We might still be on the session if we win after the Tuesday.
You never
know,
man. We
might be 4 days deep into the session. So, or we'll be crying into our laps right now thinking, he should have started Grealish and he went with da-da-da. And we'll have all the expected moans. But I hope, I've got a really good feeling about this game. And listen, I've cursed them, haven't I? We're going to get absolutely battered now. 5-0. No, honest to God, I think counter-attacking is the way to go, like you outlined. And I think with that pace, Saka, Sterling, even if he pulls one out of the bag and starts with Rashford, that might be the way to go. You know, if Kane's looking jaded, I'm excited about this.
I think it's down to the players he selects in that starting lineup is very, very important against Germany. And obviously, we're not going to dominate the ball against the Germans, so there is going to be that opportunity to hit on the counter-attack. We'll see what kind of tactical manager Southgate is when he comes up against like a veteran in Joachim Löw. So we'll see what kind of manager he really is, because he's not an experienced coach. He's not really a kind of a tactical genius, or you know, he needs to pull out a masterclass here. So we'll need to see what Gareth Southgate's really, really made of in that game. So it should be really, really interesting. So we're gonna have all the sort of review on that next week. So thank you very much for listening. As always, make sure you check us out on social media, listen to all our other episodes, up to episode 23 now, or 22 now.
22.
So yeah. So make sure you check out all the other ones in the past, and we will see you again next week.
It's good to have you back, son.
Always good to be back, man. Always good to be back in Brum.